Content warning. Discussions of violence, abortion, war, torture, death of adults, children and babies, current politics in the UK, US, and cannibalism that some people may find disturbing.
Welcome to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for listening. This is episode 6, Portrait of a Witch, part 1. This episode is dedicated to Eleanor Rogerson. Today we are joined by Diane Perkis. Diane is a professor of English literature at Keble College, Oxford University. She has published widely on the supernatural and its history, and is currently working on a book of unusual witches. Her book, English Food, A People's History, will be published in November by HarperCollins.
That's right, yes, HarperCollins.
That all sounds very exciting. I'm very excited for a book about food.
And it's connected with witches, actually, because one of the areas of conflict among neighbours that leads to witchcraft accusation is actually quarrels about spoiled food or about food preparation, like butter churning, going wrong. So actually, I got into food via witches.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so this episode is called Portrait of a Witch because we're especially interested to find out where the images of a witch come from. What a witch looks like, what they do, how they behave, all these stereotypes about witches came from somewhere. And our reason for asking you to join us today, Diane, is to find this out.
So food being one of them, apparently.
Yes, absolutely. And that points us towards a really important element in the witch figure. And that is the witch is the opposite of what you as a woman are meant to be. So depending on what your era thinks a woman is meant to be, the witch is the antithesis of that. Now, there are some historical constants, one of which is, for example, that women are meant to provide food. Typically, they're meant to prepare food. They're meant to turn a natural thing into a cultural thing. So, you know, a bag of flour into a cake. And in all those ways, women kind of stand on the threshold of the natural world and make it into a cultural world. The thing is that witches, in the 17th century and in the 16th century too, are women who ruin that. Because if you're a subsistence person, i.e. an agricultural laborer who doesn't own any land, one of the ways you could make a bit of money was to turn milk into butter, and by churning that, sell it at market, and then it gets taken up to London and eaten by rich people. Hurrah. So you're now slightly better off. But witches were believed to ruin butter formation. If you've ever tried churning butter at school by shaking cream in a jar, it doesn't always go the way it ought to. No. It doesn't always work the way you might hope it would. A tiny thing like the milk being slightly sour can make it go wrong. So it's a little bit of a fragile process. And therefore, what we see is a lot of witchcraft accusations turning on witches spoiling butter, which might seem really trivial to us. But let's bear in mind that you couldn't just go down to Tesco's and buy another pint of cream. And also that people are living in a horrendous economic situation whereby any food loss could seriously impact them and their entire household. Beer was also something women were supposed to make and supposed to provide to other people, and witches could ruin that as well. There are a few stories as well of witches bewitching domestic food animals like hens and pigs. So it's interesting that witchcraft seems to be the antithesis of what women are meant to do. What women are meant to do is make all this natural stuff into something human. And what witches seem to do is to take it to the negative side of nature, to make it spoiled or decaying or stinking or bloodstained, or any other aspect of nature which we feel uncomfortable about. So one thing that a witch is, therefore, is the opposite of what a woman is meant to be. It therefore follows that witches are also the antithesis of good mothers, which is why the other thing that they get bailed up for all the time by accusers is killing babies or making babies and children sick. So obviously your mother is supposed to be, particularly in this pre-industrial and mostly in the countryside kind of region and period, your mother is supposed to be the one who takes care of you in illness. And she is the one who is going to kind of mop your fevered brow and sit with you and tell you stories and pray for you and do all those sort of caring things. Witches do the exact opposite. They, by speaking to a child, may enter into that child and turn that child sick. So the very softness and responsiveness and vulnerability of the child becomes a point of entry for the witch. And again, she's doing exactly what women aren't supposed to do. And the third example I was going to give is just shouting a lot. A lot, there's a strong connection between witches and being what was charmingly called cursed of your tongue. I definitely aspire to being cursed of my tongue, which is where, you know, someone cuts you off at a roundabout, you give them the finger and say a few choice words. That's the kind of thing that would make people think you might be a bit witchy.
You think I might be a bit witchy?
My mum and nana would definitely have been a bit witchy.
There are very many women who would qualify for being a bit witchy in those circumstances. And all those kind of women that Laura Gowing writes about so brilliantly in her work, who quarrel with other women, and they just come up with the most amazing, inventive Shakespearean strings of insults for one another. That was a little bit witchy as well. Partly because verbal power isn't supposed to be something that women have. Women aren't supposed to be strong with their tongues. And if they are, it's a little bit genderqueer, and it's also transgressive. So the final thing we know about witches that connects with that is that witches were a little bit genderqueer. If you think about Macbeth, which is accurate on this, however wrong it is in other respects, Banquo's first reaction to the witches is to say, you should be women, but your beards forbid me to interpret that you are so. Well, rationalizing this a bit, the majority of women accused of witchcraft in 17th century England were actually postmenopausal. So at the point where you're postmenopause, you start developing a little bit of facial hair. And typically that's also often where your facial fat falls away and your skin hardens a bit. And you get the more characteristic witchy face with the hollow cheeks and the nose stands out more. And those characteristics could be deemed as sort of ungendering, because in a way, menopause and postmenopause feels like an ungendering. The base fact is that you're losing some of the feminine characteristics that are expected of women, like softer skin and softer temperament and a softer body.
Right.
So the postmenopausal woman is seen, therefore, as not a proper woman in the same kind of way that the witch who ruins your butter or makes your kids sick is seen as not a proper woman. She's not fully reproductive. Therefore, she can't be doing the kinds of things that women are supposed to be doing, which is basically nurturative work, procreation, managing and wrangling nature so men don't have to touch it. And all those kinds of jobs are kind of cut off by the idea of the sort of hardness and hairiness of the postmenopausal body. So, which is a genderqueer. If you're a bit genderqueer naturally, then that might make you more liable to an accusation at an early stage. So in general, in every era, including our own, witches are whatever the patriarchy dislikes most, and the opposite of whatever the patriarchy wants women to be.
Everything always comes back to the patriarchy, every time.
Definitely in the case of witchcraft. But we also know, as Margaret Atwood fully understands in her brilliant dystopian Handmaid's Tale, women are often the principal enforcers to one another. And that was the case in the era of witchcraft persecution. You were much more likely to be accused of witchcraft by another woman than you were by a man, though it was men and men's response that made the legal process happen. So just having a neighbor accuse you of witchcraft wouldn't necessarily get you into any trouble unless an elite man accepted their claim. And that only occurred where elite men were informed about demonology, which they understood as a kind of continental intellectual trend. Bit like deconstruction, really, that they'd all read up on and were kind of proud of knowing about. If your local JP or your local landowner was that kind of person, then you were in heaps of trouble if women accused you. But in other areas where maybe the local JP was less well informed about demons, you might actually not even get arrested. And it's worth remembering at this stage that even when you've been arraigned for witchcraft, you're more likely to be acquitted than convicted.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So for the number of witches that were people that were accused of witchcraft, around half of them were actually executed. One of them was let go because the supervising lieutenant thought that she was too pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we have various theories that some were actually let go after people appealed for them, and some may have died in prison.
Yeah, that happened a lot, unfortunately. I mean, not being executed didn't necessarily mean you survived the process, alas. Yeah. You could easily just die in jail, remembering that there were actually no provisions to feed prisoners at the time of witchcraft trials. So unless your family came round with food, your only hope was to buy it from your jailer. And another characteristic of women accused of witchcraft for the most part is that they tend to be poor. So it's highly unlikely that they would have been in a position to bribe their jailer to, you know, get some Deliveroo in.
yeah.
So that they're more likely than other prisoners to actually die of being imprisoned. And that also goes with the advanced age factor that I mentioned earlier.
That's awful.
I mean, I don't know how prevalent this is like across the country, but certainly in the Northeast, as we would have mentioned in previous episodes, the Newcastle was still reeling from a really bad plague, and then the Scottish occupation and the Civil War, which I suppose left a lot of women husbandless, or you know, no sons, maybe fathers as well absent. Is that something that sort of would be against you if you were sort of going to be accused of being a witch? Sort of, is that a possibility that like the...
Definitely that's going to be part of it. But in addition, in the South, during the years of the English Civil War, the King versus Parliament Civil War, there's a significantly savage witch hunt in the area controlled by Parliament that most of your listeners will know about, because they'll probably know about the Witchfinder General Matthew Hopkins.
Yeah.
And that isn't a direct response to the Civil War, but an indirect response to the sort of psychic tensions of having a civil war in your country. And both sides, but particularly the parliamentarian side, become more and more anxious about the presence of demons in their opposite ranks. So my favorite one of these is that they decide Prince Rupert's dog is a demon. So it probably was a little bit odd looking and worrying, but they believed it was a demon because it ran into battle with him and didn't get shot. And you'll remember that I told you about witches having sort of harder bodies than most women. The same kind of applied to the dog, that the fact that it seemed bulletproof meant that they decided it was demonic.
Right.
So a lot of this is about ideologies of the natural and the unnatural. They decided the dog was unnatural. And in the same kind of way, there's also, and this is much less cheerful than the boy story, the dog was called Boy, much less cheerful than that. The slaughter of the women after the Battle of Naseby, where the successful parliamentarian army, the New Model Army, came across a group of women, royalist camp followers, who didn't appear to speak English. We don't know whether they spoke Gaelic or Welsh, but probably it was one of those. And so the parliamentarians killed them on the ground that if they couldn't speak English, they were witches. So, I mean, just by being a foreigner, you might be perceived to have a power of your tongue that the person you're confronting doesn't have, and that's witchy enough to kill you. So coming back to Matthew Hopkins, he's a further example of how these tensions work themselves out in the community. So you've got people who are terrified all the time, maybe terrified for loved ones, maybe terrified for their food supply, maybe terrified because they're on a particular political side and they're worried the war's going in the wrong, quote, direction. And fear always tends to work itself out by, let's find a scapegoat today, And once we rid ourselves of that person, we'll all be golden, it'll be sorted. And so those kinds of terrors easily surface and attach themselves to anybody who talks a bit funny or looks a bit funny or walks a bit funny.
So if we were to look at, if we were, anybody were to go into the internet and search for witch and look at images, there are certain traits that everybody seems to agree that a witch has, what they're wearing and also their appearance. I guess I'm really curious to know, like, how we all decided that a witch probably had a big nose. I think you've already touched on that. Probably had warts on their face. Was always pretty hunched. Had long fingers.
The long fingers, the long nose. They have the pointy hat. Even like the kind of the colour of the skin is always either really pale or the green.
I think a lot of this was confirmed by the film of The Wizard of Oz, which kind of indelibly embedded in the popular imagination a particular version of the witch that was a coalescence of different images that had circulated in the past in children's books in the 19th century. And before that, in what were charmingly cool chapbooks, which you gave to the little ones to read, and they were 8 pages long. And they quite often told the story of scary witches riding on broomsticks. You didn't mention broomsticks, but they're another feature of this. And wearing the kind of hat that people believed that everyone wore in the 17th century, though actually that kind of hat is really a Puritan hat. So there's something kind of comic and ironic that Puritans were the most down on witches, and they end up having one of their dress code elements incorporated into the figure of the witch. But the others are just, as I said, images of postmenopausal women, really. Mm-hmm. Women who lack the qualities that we associate with young femininity. Women who have long fingers because they're skinny. Women who have long pointy noses because their faces are gaunt. Women who are pale because they're no longer getting those helpful hormonal surges that keep your skin young and flat fresh. Women who look a bit stringy, and all those qualities associated with the witch are really a demonization, I would suggest, of old age. And even though we as a society are trying to fitfully, inadequately, for a kind of body positivity, I would suggest that many people are still very uncomfortable with the idea of visible older women. Just look at Hollywood casting.
Yeah.
An example of what I mean. There was a movie about 30 years ago called Searching for Deborah Winger. And when I tell women your age about it, one of the things they always say is, who was Deborah Winger? And that's exactly the point. Once once you've been in Hollywood movies for 10 years, unless you're Meryl Streep, that's your lot.
That's a bit depressing.
It is something that's becoming more well known and talked about. And yeah, and I think even if you compare that to the Newcastle trials, we kind of know that the women were older, like the ones that they were older women, and obviously with the Civil War and Newcastle was hit quite hard at the time, there was a lot of women who were, obviously I don't believe this, but they were kind of past the age of use almost.
It is that. If your principal use as a woman in theology is that you're supposed to reproduce, and that's meant to be your main function, and your subsidiary function is looking after children or looking after the household, then yes, you do get too old for it at the menopause. And so there is some sense in which you're a spare mouth, you're a drain on the parish. And they literally felt that. I mean, it was obligatory in 17th century England for each parish to provide for its own poor. And so obviously, going back to benefits cheats in a way, one of the things that the witch trials are about is people's sense that there's this incredibly heavy burden of elderly women that aren't doing any good and that aren't for anything, and that therefore must be a giant nuisance to the entire community. Now, it's not necessarily a cynical kind of equation, well, let's get rid of the elderly pensioners, but it is almost that. And I mean, we're suffering a demographic crisis now that I suspect won't be especially beneficial for elderly women. Possibly not for elderly men either. And at times, some of the more hardline rhetoric we saw from right-wing politicians during the pandemic was along the lines of, well, the people who are dying are a waste of space anyway, because they're all over 70. That kind of thinking is very much abroad in a society where meeting people's basic needs is much more difficult and much more marginal.
We've talked about this in like previous episodes as well, but it's almost that, like, the root cause of kind of what people believed witches to be and like their own society hasn't really changed. We just have different names and different terms for it. Like, that core ideology.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And if you look at the surge of TikTok witches now, and the witches hexing Donald Trump, in a way, they are performatively acting out that role, which they're highly conscious of, I suspect, that witches are the people who are the opposite of what the patriarchy says women should be, wants women to be, and insists that women must try to be. Be interesting how that plays out in relation to Roe v. Wade and its unfortunate striking down, because I suspect we're now going to see in America the demonization of abortion providers in those same red states where they're eagerly passing laws to restrict women's access to abortion. I suspect that not only women who themselves seek abortions, but women who provide abortions will now be demonized with a rhetoric of witchcraft. And the reason I think that is because Donald Trump and his supporters have already done some of that work. If you look at the iconography surrounding Trump as the savior of babies, I'm not sure if you've seen these images of a golden-haired Donald Trump snatching babies out of the grasp of an enormous, scary Hillary Clinton who wants to devour them and who has long fingers and long fingernails. And that itself is kind of recollection of the fact that the Trump campaign not only almost accurately described metaphorically demonized Hillary Clinton, but also literally demonized her. They literally believed her to be possessed by devils. It's a big part of Pizzagate that the babies that are disappearing are somehow being devoured by especially women, but also some men on the Democrat wing of politics. So that kind of thinking is bubbled up through the patriarchy because it's now become useful again, perhaps in a world where men feel themselves to have lost some power. And that, of course, is what big civil wars and divisions in society do. You always have a group of losers. And it's that group of losers, or people who fear that they're going to be in that group of losers, who then pounce not on their male opponents, but on very vulnerable people that they know they can control.
Wow.
Yeah, I want to make you scared. I don't think people are scared enough. I don't think people are scared enough by witches and the history of witches, because this is a terrifying thing. This is that thing where you can be apparently perfectly happy and settled in your community with friends and a social life and a high level of acceptance. And in less than a year, it can be turned around completely and you are a total pariah and no one will speak for you.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to part one of Portrait of a Witch. This is the Newcastle Witches podcast. We'll be back next time with Portrait of a Witch part two.